Hello and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. Beginning today with the Boston Globe. By revisiting 1769 protest, Lexington is spinning her story. Reenactment is empowering. By Jessica Ma. Lexington, Massachusetts. In front of the Lexington Women's Monument, a woman dressed in a straw hat, petticoat, and an apron sat at a spinning wheel, tapping her foot on the pedal. She was participating in a tribute to Anna Harrington's spinning wheel protest, held on August 31, 1769. Back then, 45 women gathered at Harrington's home for a spinning contest to protest imported British textiles by making their own fabric. Over 250 years later, Lexington women paid tribute to this history, or her story, by recreating the event. On August 23rd, 45 women surrounded the woman playing Harrington. Some were dressed in T-shirts and sneakers, others in 18th century period outfits. Instead of spinning fabric, though, the women spun purple and white umbrellas. It's hard to find 45 people with period outfits and spinning wheels, so I thought, what can you spin? Umbrellas, said Jesse Steigerwald, the president of Lex See Her, a local group that organized the event. On the sunny day, a small band's hum of recorders and the strumming of a guitar rang in the air next to the performers. The reenactors sang songs about Lexington's women's history. Something must be done. Something must be spun, they sang in unison. The event also recognized 43 women from the colonial period and modern day for their contributions to the Lexington community, 25 of whom attended the event. One by one, each woman walked up to the monument and received a yellow flower. Thelma Goldberg, one of the honorees, started a local dance studio. She said that teaching the art was her true calling, and that the recognition was a testament to Lexington's empowerment of women throughout history. It's possible for me to do whatever I want to do in this town, Goldberg said. I have a lot of sisters here among this community. On the edge of the lawn, an antique spinning wheel, owned by an attendee, Daphne Mazouz, was on display. She found the mid-19th century machine on Facebook and learned about the craft from online forums. There are many centuries of histories of these tools, Mazouz said. I'm really into techniques and how things work. Spinning was a way for Harrington and women to use art and technical skills to politically organize, said Claire Toff Miriam, Mazouz's wife, who also came to the event. Today, the fiber arts continue to be used for protest, the couple said. For so many people, having a creative, constructive, and productive outlet is a really important thing for their own well-being in difficult political times, Mazouz said. In a tent near the reenactment site, attendees gathered around tables to knit and crochet colorful squares. The squares will be assembled into blankets for refugees coming to the United States. Jules Redfield, 17, who attends Lexington High School, was working on her own square while surrounded by her peers. Watching the historical reenactment felt empowering, she said. Spinning is a very unique way to protest, Redfield said. We don't hear as much about women protesting in history. Harrington's story resonates no matter the time period, Steigerwald said. During troubling times, there can be an inclination to find distraction, she said. When people learn about Harrington's spinning protest, Steigerwald hopes they think to themselves, wow, those old-fashioned women did something really bold and stuck their necks out. The way American history has truly unfolded was dictated by every individual who decided to do something, she said. From the New York Times. Dad lost, but there's an upside. Hope Waltz, the daughter of last year's Democratic vice presidential nominee, reflects. By Callie Holterman. Bozeman, Montana. For Hope Waltz, the night of the 2024 presidential election can be summed up in two selfies. Around 8 p.m., she photographed herself beaming into a mirror in a Washington hotel room, wearing a blue hoodie in support of the Democratic ticket that included her father, Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota, as its vice presidential nominee. Later that evening, she took a close-up of her face, a mixture of tears and mascara streaming down her cheeks. Afterward, she walked around Washington with campaign staff members and began to process that the wildest 3 months of her life had ended in heartbreak. It is a new reality, Ms. Waltz, now 24, said in an interview this month. I kind of accepted that I was never going to be the same, and I don't want to be. Ms. Waltz has had, to put it mildly, an unusual year. Last summer, her father was the surprise selection to be Vice President Kamala Harris's running mate after beating out a field of better-known contenders on the national stage. The Waltz family, Tim and his wife Gwen, who met as teachers, and their children Hope and her younger brother Gus, was thrust into the national spotlight practically overnight. Ms. Waltz, then 23, spent the rest of the campaign crisscrossing the country by her father's side. The tattooed Gen Z foil to his slightly square Midwestern dad. Now Ms. Waltz is readjusting to life after an especially intense spurt in the public eye. Rather than retreat, though, she is entering the political fray more than ever before. 2 days after the election, Ms. Waltz opened TikTok and began processing her feelings with the camera rolling. She reflected on how the results would affect the country's most vulnerable populations. One commenter told her to grow up. Another said she should take a shower. She figured she had struck a nerve, so she kept going. Ms. Waltz has picked up more than 500,000 followers on TikTok in less than a year, posting videos about reproductive health care and immigration, along with everyday dispatches on hiking, skin care, and Trader Joe's. She hopes to be an approachable face for members of her generation who want to engage with progressive politics, and maybe also Love Island, USA. Her TikTok account has helped recast her as a new kind of messenger for a party that has been searching for digital evangelists. But unlike some Democrats, she does not think the party needs a towering bro podcaster at the center of its own manosphere. There's not going to be a Joe Rogan of the left. There's going to be many individual characters that fill the void, she said. She continued, I was kind of thrown into it, But now I'm like, oh, maybe I can be a part of that. A normal life? Ms. Walls has lived in Bozeman, Montana since 2021, when she transferred to Montana State University from the University of Minnesota. She had been hoping to take on young adulthood with a bit of space from the state her father had governed since 2019. A week after the election, she returned to Bozeman and tried to settle back into her routines. She works as a ski instructor at Big Sky Ski Resort in the winters and at a homeless shelter year-round. She shares an apartment with two roommates, visits breweries with her boyfriend, and obsesses over the Real Housewives of Salt Lake City. Very often, with political families, you see just one dimension of them, she said while on a hike in Bozeman. I'm pretty determined to be like. Many of us are not normal. Ms. Waltz grew up in Mankato, Minnesota, an hour and a half south of the Twin Cities. Her father was elected to the House of Representatives when she was six, and her brother Gus, now 18, was born just a few weeks before that election. The family's finances were modest enough to become a talking point in the 2024 campaign. When the Veep stakes got serious last summer, she had been finishing up a four-day valet gig at Big Sky and recovering from a nasty bout of strep throat. In a phone interview, Mr. Waltz said he had called his daughter the day before the decision was finalized to voice his nerves. I was, I think, probably at that point, quite honestly, trying to find a way to maybe get out of things, Mr. Waltz said. She said, this is what you do. If it's the time to serve, you're going to do it. He asked her to join him on the campaign trail, a period Ms. Waltz describes as equal parts exhilarating and bizarre. She cracked jokes with reporters about Diet Mountain Dew, her father's beverage of choice, at a campaign stop in Phoenix, and chatted about tattoos at a fundraiser with Orlando Bloom. The spotlight was harsher than usual, she said, especially when Gus made headlines for showing his emotions during the Democratic National Convention. He was, at the time, a 17-year-old kid, and I'm like, this is ridiculous, Ms. Waltz said. There are full-blown adults saying these terrible, terrible things. Still, Ella Emhoff, Ms. Harris's stepdaughter, was impressed by Ms. Waltz's ability to adapt to the intensity of campaign life. Ms. Emhoff, 26, wrote in an email that the two had hit it off immediately. She stepped up and handled a new, chaotic, and stressful reality like she'd been doing it forever, she said. Finally free. The first video Ms. Waltz posted after the election was of her and Gus driving without Secret Service for the first time in months. I Won't Back Down by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers played in the background. Finally free, Gus said from behind the wheel. I would not describe it like that, Hope added diplomatically. The Harris-Waltz ticket's defeat came with one small upside for Ms. Waltz. She has more latitude to speak her mind than she might have if her father had won. Other young family members of the 2024 candidates have been making their way on TikTok, too. Ms. Emhoff has returned to posting about her knitting projects. Kai Trump, the 18-year-old granddaughter of President Trump, has amassed more than 3 million followers, sharing videos about golfing and her trips to the White House. Ms. Waltz's videos, may be landing because they are so much looser than the average political TikTok, said Annie Wu Henry, a digital strategist who often works with progressive campaigns. She's not lecturing, not overproducing, just sharing her life, opinions, and reactions in a way that feels human and relatable, Ms. Henry wrote in a text message. A version of Ms. Waltz that comes across online feels familiar to Ms. Emhoff after the two spent time together during the campaign. What you see online is who she is, she said. Ms. Waltz's presentation online is deliberate enough to make a reporter wonder whether she would ever run for office herself. Never say never, she said, but probably not. I don't like being constrained. As her audience has swelled, a handful of her posts have been picked up by right-wing outlets, eager to cast her as a poster child for a woke slice of Gen Z. In March, amid campus crackdowns on pro-Palestinian activism, Ms. Waltz made Fox News headlines when she posted that she had turned down admission to a master's in social work program because she believed the school she was admitted to had not protected students' right to protest. Ms. Waltz declined to say which school. In June, she praised Zohran Mamdani's style of messaging on progressive policies after his victory in the Democratic mayoral primary in New York City. The Fox News host Laura Ingraham played the clip on her show and said, "You just lost about 100,000 brain cells by watching that soundbite." In a follow-up video that has been viewed more than 400,000 times, Ms. Waltz said she felt genuinely sad for Ms. Ingraham. "Get well soon, Laura," she added. Mr. Waltz, who is still governor of Minnesota, said he did not worry about how his daughter's videos would reflect on him. "I worry about her safety," he said. "But I also am very hesitant to tone her down, because I think her generation needs these different voices, and I think she's a good one." Ms. Waltz believes that the unapologetic approach is something Democrats could use a little more of. "We should just be outward in our progressiveness," she said. "We don't need to pander to people that don't like us." Back in Bozeman, Ms. Waltz changed into green cargo shorts and a gray crewneck sweatshirt for her night shift at the emergency shelter, where she has worked since 2023. She completed intake paperwork for a man who said he had been unhoused for the past 2 years and was on his way to Minnesota. She smiled, not mentioning that her father happened to be the state's top official. "I'm from there," she said. From the Associated Press, doctors see nuanced reality of hormone therapy for menopause, by Laura Ungar. Menopause can usher in a host of disruptive symptoms, including hot flashes, night sweats, and sleep problems. Hormone therapy promises relief, but many women wonder about taking it. That's because the treatment, the subject of a recent expert panel convened by the Food and Drug Administration, has long been shrouded in uncertainty. It was once used routinely, but in 2002, research testing one type was stopped early because of concerns about increased risks of breast cancer and blood clots. Concerns lingered, even though later studies showed the benefits of today's hormone therapies outweigh the risks for many women. There's still a lot of confusion and a lot of fear, said Grayson Leverins, a 50-year-old from Durham, North Carolina, who hesitated to take it, but is glad she did. Others, increasingly, are also giving hormone therapy a second look. But experts continue to disagree about how to present the treatment's pros and cons. The FDA-assembled panel stressed the benefits and suggested health warnings be removed from at least some versions, prompting dozens of experts to call for more input before making any changes. Doctors say hormone therapy is a great option for many, but not all, menopausal women, and it's important to understand the nuanced reality of these treatments before deciding what's best. How hormone therapy works. It treats symptoms that can arise when menstruation winds down and ends, causing levels of estrogen and progesterone to drop very low. One type is low-dose vaginal estrogen therapy. Because it's applied into the vagina, very little circulates in the blood, and the risks are far lower. Doctors say it's a good option for women whose biggest complaint is vaginal dryness. Whole-body therapy includes pills, patches, sprays, gels, or a vaginal ring that deliver doses of hormones into the bloodstream at levels high enough to have significant effects on symptoms like hot flashes. Such systemic hormones include estrogens and progestogens. Jennifer Zwink, a nurse in Castle Rock, Colorado, began using an estrogen patch more than a year ago, and also has an IUD, which gives her progesterone. The treatment has relieved her hot flashes, improved her sleep, and eased her joint pain and bloating. It's not like a 100% magic wand, she said, but it definitely has made a significant difference. The Menopause Society says hormone therapy can lower the risk of cardiovascular disease if started within 10 years of reaching menopause. It may also reduce the risk of type 2 diabetes and maintain bone density for longer. They might have a drop in their bone density at age 60 instead of at age 50, said Dr. Marga Eva Morris Cole, an OBGYN with Duke University. Hormone therapy carries some risks. When Leverins was first prescribed hormone therapy last year, she kept worrying about the risks she'd heard about, then finally decided, I can't live like this anymore. With a combination of three medications, her anxiety lifted, her sleep improved, her joint pain and hot flashes went away. I just feel like myself again, she said. Doctors say many patients hesitate to try hormones, and they try to reassure them. Women can use estrogen therapy for 7 years, and estrogen-progestogen therapy for 3 to 5 years, before breast cancer risk goes up, according to the Menopause Society. The group says both estrogen therapy and estrogen-progestogen therapy increase the risk of stroke, which goes away soon after stopping hormones. The risk of blood clots rises if you take hormones by mouth, but may be lower if you use a patch, gel, or spray. A lot of these risks are small, said Dr. Nanette Santoro, an OBGYN at the University of Colorado, and they have to be weighed against the benefit of symptom relief. Age, medical history, and how long women stay on the hormones are also considerations. Many women take them for around 5 years, and those who've had a stroke or certain other conditions, may be advised against using them at all. Debate on changing warnings on hormone medications. Doctors are divided over whether there should be changes in black box health warnings on some hormone treatments. All estrogen drugs still carry boxed warnings about the higher rates of stroke, blood clots, and cognitive problems among women taking the medications. Most of the physicians at the recent expert panel meeting convened by the FDA prescribe the hormones or are involved with a pharmaceutical industry campaign opposing the warning label. A letter signed by 76 doctors and researchers argues that removing label warnings without adequate scientific assessment puts patients at risk, and asked the agency to hold an advisory committee meeting with a public hearing before making any changes. In the meantime, doctors urge people to be wary of misinformation, like false claims or social media posts that hormones will prevent dementia and ensure a healthy old age. We can't say that you are going to live a longer, healthier life because you took hormones, Dukes Cole said. I don't want the pendulum to go so far that people feel that it is promising health for the next 30 to 40 years. Alternatives to hormone therapy for menopause. Santoro pointed to a new non-hormonal medication called fezolinetant, marketed as Veozah, for hot flashes and night sweats. The anti-epileptic medication gabapentin, in low doses, can also be used for hot flashes, and a moisturizer can improve vaginal dryness. Experts also say regular exercise and a healthy diet can help manage symptoms. Santoro urged against the wild proliferation of supplements claiming to be menopause cure-alls. Everybody is in on the menopause gold rush, she said. If it looks too good to be true, it probably is. From Cosmopolitan, Jessica Springsteen, Let Her Dreams Be Too Big, and then jumped right over them. The decorated equestrian is sensitive, structured, and secretly superstitious. She journals before bed, visualizes her rides, and only recently got comfortable saying her goals out loud. One of them was winning an Olympic medal. She's already done that. The next one? Maybe it's unpacking her suitcase. By Alexandra Whitaker. Jessica Springsteen remembers the fear. It was a few months ago, during a night competition, and she was in the ring with her horse, Dawn, ready to hurdle over obstacles at top speed. Despite her years competing in equestrian and having an Olympic silver medal to her name, those jitters steadily crept in, and she needed to take a second. I was so nervous that I stopped him to calm myself, she reflects. I took a deep breath, and he immediately copied me and took a huge deep breath too. It was no shock that beneath her, Dawn responded in perfect sync, exhaling with her, as if to say, we've got this. They're feeling what you are, says Jessica, as she sits in a brightly lit living room. It's the apartment of her boyfriend, a fellow equestrian. Those moments just remind me how connected we really are. A bond like this doesn't happen by chance. It can take years to build, she says, and it is actually the most important thing. It's kind of hard to see when you're watching. For Jessica, who's been an equestrian since she was 5 years old, this isn't just a sport. It's a language of intuition, presence, and connection that's helped her evolve into the woman and competitor we see today. It's taken her from being a shy kid on a New Jersey farm who was too afraid to verbally declare, "I want to go to the Olympics," to actually going to the 2020 Tokyo Games and winning silver in team jumping. Since becoming an Olympic medalist and trending globally in the aftermath, because, yes, Jessica is the daughter of Bruce Springsteen and Patti Sciarfa, the equestrian has continued to build momentum in the sport. In 2023, she secured wins at the FEI Jumping Nations Cup of USA and the Winter Equestrian Festival. And in 2022 and 2023, she took first place at the Ultra Elite Global Champions Tour Grand Prix of London. Just days before we met on Zoom in August, Jessica was in Valkenswaard, Netherlands, competing at the 2025 Longines Tops International Arena Summer Classic, where she ultimately won gold. Most recently, the fierce show jumping competitor was invited to join Longines Global Champions Tour this September in New York City, a competition reserved only for the top-ranked equestrian jumping teams in the world. And in between all this competing and training, she works with Gallop NYC, a therapeutic riding nonprofit that she calls incredibly healing. But her eyes aren't only on the podium. Instead, she's looking inward. "What I'm working on right now is being a little bit more present and enjoying the process more," she says. "I have definitely had moments where I'm really focused on the end result and I'm not enjoying the journey. I think especially as you get older, you can start to put more pressure on yourself." She's in a chaotic world full of intense travel schedules, big personalities, yes, of both humans and horses, and the humbling truth that no matter how good you are, anything can happen in the ring. But still, she thrives, because when Jessica Springsteen takes a deep breath before a competition, her horse takes one too. That's not just training, it's trust. Question: what drew you to horses and show jumping in the first place? Was there a single moment that made you say, "This is it for me"? It started because my mom had always wanted to ride. When she was younger, she was horse crazy, but she never had the chance to do it. We moved to a farm in New Jersey, and she started taking lessons. When I saw her do it, I wanted to as well. And then it just escalated. It naturally happened that it was jumping, which is really funny because I was terrified of jumping when I was younger. You jump high. What would your younger self say if she knew you grew up to jump professionally? I was always truly terrified of jumping, but I still never thought, "I'm not going to do this." It was always, "I'm doing it anyway." But I still had so much fear. I still get nervous, but I don't have that fear for my life that I did. Looking back, I'm like, wow, I'm proud of her. Do you consider yourself a competitive person? It's really funny because I don't consider myself competitive. Whenever I say that, my friends and family are like, "No, you're not competitive." but I don't see it within myself. I try to psych myself down, even before a big competition where people are going really fast, like, oh, I'm just going to take it easy. And then I get out there and I go full out. I don't know if it's my way of calming myself down, but once I'm in the ring and I hear that bell go off, I go into another zone. How do you cope with pre-performance jitters? I grew up figure skating, and waiting to hit the ice was always the worst. All that anticipation with nothing to do. It's so similar because it has so much to do with timing and precision. With horses, it's a lot of managing your nerves because you don't want the horse to pick up on them. A little bit ago, I started visualizing my course, how I wanted it to feel, and imagined it going. Of course, things don't always go according to plan, but I found that it really helped me stay calm. I focus on what I can control. It's so easy in moments of high stress to let emotions take the driver's seat. I did that for such a long time. I read a few books that helped me be more intentional about not doing that. That really helped me find a lot more of my confidence. What were the books? One is called The Champion's Mind. I went through it and I would highlight passages that really spoke to me before a big competition. Your mind is everything. In all sports, there is a huge mental component. Show jumping isn't the most mainstream sport either. What is something about it that people misunderstand? Whenever I talk about riding, a lot of people think I'm racing. I feel like that's what people jump to, that I'm racing or doing dressage. Editor's note, dressage, sometimes called the ballet of horse riding, requires a rider and horse to perform a series of elegant movements together. Think less obstacle jumping, more controlled routines. But I think that people ultimately don't understand the partnership of you and your horse, what goes into that, and how important it is. How do you establish that partnership? Is it usually one bonding moment, or is it built over time? It's completely different for each horse. Sometimes I have that instant gel where you just get each other from the get-go, but most of the time it takes longer. Once you have that bond, though, it's the best feeling, and I feel like that's where sensitivity really plays a big role. Tell me about some of your current horses and the bonds you share. I saw Dawn on Instagram the other day looking dapper. I have three horses, Dawn, Naomi, and Cayman. Dawn, my horse that I went to the Olympics on, is my heart. I've had him for 6 years now, and he is the happiest horse. You walk into the barn, and he whinnies at you. He wants attention, and he's always so much fun to compete with. You really feel the joy in him. Naomi is also amazing. She's so competitive. She really gives you that extra inch. We finally gelled this past year. It took so much time. Cayman, I'm still working to figure out. We get it sometimes, and then the next round I'm like, what just happened? I didn't expect that. He is so unpredictable and really keeps me and my team guessing. He has so much personality. And sometimes he'll just do the craziest things. You have to laugh at it. He's so funny. It sounds like you've formed close relationships at the barn. What do your relationships look like outside of riding? I made the most amazing relationships in college with people who have become my lifelong friends. Having that outside of the riding has been incredible for me. We're a 7-minute voice note crew. Like, literally, We will send books back and forth to each other that way. It's the best way to stay in touch, especially with different time zones, because then you can just respond whenever. I have a friend who does the same. I joke it's her podcast. Who are you in the friend group? That's a good question. I'd say I'm a listener. I love hearing whatever is going on in someone's life and trying to be as supportive as possible. I'm definitely the least organized and the worst planner of the group. So they are the ones who are like, okay, you're going to be in New York this week. We're going to do this. That's what I need in my life. Someone who's going to take the wheel. Type A friends are great to have. What is your most type A quality? I'm not super into astrology, but I'm a Capricorn, which is supposed to be so type A. I don't see those qualities in myself, but I would love to be more organized and leading the way. My most type A quality is that I've got this 5-year journal. It's short, just a half a page a day, and since I started, I have not missed a day. Before I go to sleep, I don't care what happened that day. I will write in my journal. I'm proud to say I've been really consistent with it. That, and washing my face before bed. That's a must after riding all day. Any type B traits? I will get home from a trip and leave a suitcase packed for, like, way too long. Or I'll leave things in packing cubes forever, because they're kind of organized that way. The cubes are out, and I'm like, okay, that kind of works. Let's just leave them to the side for now. That is genuinely so relatable. I know you're dialing in from your boyfriend's house, who's also an equestrian. What's it been like having a partner in the same field? It's been really great for me. It's so nice to be able to share the sport with someone. It involves so much traveling, and you are on your own so much. So to be able to do it together is the best thing ever. He's so positive, supportive, and mentally strong. That's got to be extra nice, because as you said, every sport is super mental. Sometimes you feel like you're the only person having strong feelings, but everyone has them. I can kind of say any crazy thought or feeling I'm having, and he's just like, okay, let's figure this out. He has been really grounding for me in that sense. He is so kind and probably the least judgmental person I've ever met. How would you describe yourself as an athlete? I think sensitivity can be seen as a weakness in sports, but in mine, I'm able to really pick up on what my horses are feeling. So in that sense, I would say sensitive in a good way. I've really worked on my mental strength these past couple years, and I try to really enjoy myself every time I go out there. So I think joyful, too. Tell me more about sensitivity being perceived as a weakness. I'm super protective of my horses, so I always want to make sure that they're feeling 100% whenever they go in the ring. But I've been told so many times that I'm overly sensitive. I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. I think that when you're working really hard at something and you have ups and downs, it can be really emotional. I think in our sport, being able to really feel what your horse is feeling is important. I think sensitivity can be a superpower. You mentioned mental strength. Tell me about a time you had to be mentally tough to overcome an obstacle. In the months leading up to the 2020 Olympics and working hard to make that team, there was a moment where I really had to build my inner confidence. I had to find those tools because I hadn't really dug into them as much. I had always relied on external validation. But there was a big moment for me where I was like, okay, I really need to build up my confidence without that. I was reading another book that said, you have to believe in yourself before you've done the hard thing. You have to believe you can do it before you have the proof you actually can. It spoke to me. Building self-belief was something I worked on really hard. And then it happened. Being an athlete at the Olympics. What was exactly the way you thought it would be, and what was not at all the way you thought it would be? Being able to compete on the competitive circuit since I was about 18 or 19, I felt comfortable when I got there. I was like, okay, this is another competition. These are people I've competed against throughout my career. But I didn't realize how quickly everything would happen. They were actually using a new format that year. Normally, you have four riders and one score doesn't count. But in 2020, they switched to only three riders and every score counted. So things were changing really quickly. It all happened so fast. I remember just watching, and all of a sudden it was like, oh my gosh, wait, we're getting a medal. I wasn't expecting how quickly it goes. You work so hard for months and months leading up to it, and then it was over. When did it finally hit you? Like, I am an Olympic medalist. It took me a long time to process it. It was my biggest dream come true. When I was young, I never wanted to say out loud, I want to go to the Olympics, because I felt like it was too big of a dream for me. So having that become a reality was just such a proud moment. When I got back home, my family planned this celebration, and it was going to be super small. But then, at the last minute, everyone was like, we're coming. This is a huge deal. Being around everyone who had been part of my journey, yeah, that's when it really hit me. The best part about milestones like the Olympics is that you can share them with the people you love. Especially thinking of you as a shy kid, gaining confidence within the sport, then to be on that global stage, it's really extraordinary. At this stage of your life, what does success feel like to you? This sport is very humbling. You can go in one week and have the most incredible week, and then the next week it can all go downhill. I've had many ups and downs, but it's also amazing because you're able to have such a long career in this sport, which I think is rare. I'm grateful for that, but I think it also makes those moments of success so much sweeter, and not just for me either. It's my whole team working together to make these moments happen. Day in and day out, it doesn't feel any less exciting or fulfilling than it did when I was young. And now for some Cosmo Sports rapid-fire questions. What's the most worn item in your closet right now? I have this oversized leather bomber jacket that I actually have to stop wearing because it's on me every day. When I ordered it online, I was like, I'm never going to wear this. I almost returned it, and now I literally wear it everywhere and anywhere. It's from Revolve, and it is just so comfortable and has a million pockets. It makes my outfits look so much cooler. What was the last thing you searched on your phone? I was looking up a horse that I saw somewhere, and I was looking for its results. Who was your crush growing up, real or fictional? Zac Efron in High School Musical. I was in love. How many unread texts do you have? Probably not that many. Should I check? I mostly WhatsApp. Okay, yes, only 5 texts and 20 WhatsApps. I admire you. My phone is not in that state. No, my little brother literally has like 450 unread messages. I'm just like, how? Your favorite reality TV show? Oh my gosh, I have a few. The Kardashians, if I had to pick one. But I also love Real Housewives. Which Real Housewives? I loved the old New York ones, but I love all of them. Do you have a pre-competition ritual or lucky charm? I'll try to wear the same necklace, and I will listen to Taylor Swift. Before, when I was doing the Olympic trials, me and my friend put on a Taylor Swift song before every trial that we had. That was like our thing. I also have a couple lucky shirts that I rotate. Your favorite Taylor Swift song? I can't pick just one. Favorite Taylor album or era? Midnights. Did you go to the Eras Tour at any point? I did. It was everything and more. From the Boston Globe magazine. I'll Take This Drudgery by Wafa Yunus. It was a quick trip to the grocery store on a blustery Friday morning. As I entered, an older gentleman stopped just ahead of me, hearing a familiar voice on his left. A small woman was pushing her groceries through the exit. "Well, look who we have here," she said. He turned toward her with a smile. "Who do we have here?" he responded excitedly. Their serendipitous meeting warmed the cold air outside, just for a moment. I quickly walked past as a small smile crept across my face. It was nice to see familiarity and community. They seemed like old-timers, people who stayed in a city long enough to be shaped by it and to shape it in return. I hurried to grab the items I needed and found the shortest line. As I waited, I overheard a conversation between a cashier and a younger employee buying his lunch for his break, 2 energy drinks, and a small, ready-made deli meal. "You're already on lunch?" the cashier asked. "Yeah, I don't know why I was scheduled this way. I just had a break an hour ago," the younger employee replied. "The rest of the day is going to feel so long now." The cashier turned to the person bagging groceries, who was standing there quietly waiting, and asked, "Could you put these things into a bag so he has something to throw his trash in? That way he won't have to get his car dirty." Then, looking back at her coworker going on break, she said, "Have a good nap," anticipating he'd get some shut-eye in his car. These moments, mundane and unpolished, speak volumes. For me, grocery shopping has become almost sterile. These fleeting snippets of humanity are rare, or perhaps I had simply stopped noticing them. Some of the blame is on me. I often skip the cashier and opt for self-checkout, breezing in and out with human interaction. Sometimes I don't even enter the store. Someone places groceries in my trunk, and a quick nod or thank you suffices. But while I avoid the drudgery of navigating aisles or waiting in line, I also miss out on something deeper, the realities and rhythms of my neighbors' lives. That morning at the store, I realized I had curated my daily experience so much that I was at risk of erasing other people, of losing my ability to recognize the weight of others' stories and the struggles, triumphs, and quiet sacrifices that often go unnoticed. It isn't just about losing social skills. It's about losing the understanding and fellowship sparked by unvarnished, everyday moments. The cashier's gentle care for a young coworker, or the lingering warmth of a chance meeting by two old friends. These are the raw materials of empathy that can be so easy to ignore. These moments force us to pause and absorb the subtle cadences of other people's lives. The sigh before a complaint, the uncertain smile in a mundane exchange, the tenderness in a single, unpolished remark. Stepping into that store reminded me of the unparalleled importance of not just human connection, but connection to place, the subtle ways the real, physical closeness of proximity can encourage us to care for one another. In just minutes, I had glimpsed diverse experiences in the snippets of passing conversation and had been forced to remember that lives are layered and complex, and those layers only reveal themselves through presence. I often wonder how I can avoid losing touch with others' experiences, or unwittingly confining myself to a bubble where everyone shares my worldview. I could bury myself in the many books and studies on the subject. Or maybe I just need more trips to the grocery store. And that brings us to the end of the program. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. And please join me again for the Women's Hour.